everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, I am bringing y'all a Mental Health Matters episode. You guys know I love mental health, and mental health is as important as your physical health, not only for you, but for the animals in our care. So today, I'm going to be speaking to the amazing Dr. Megan Breedlove, all about something that I think, unfortunately, most to maybe even all of us have experienced: compassion fatigue. And then we're going to talk a little bit about burnout and how they differ and more. So I hope you guys enjoy. Hi, Megan. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So excited to talk about this topic. I was just telling Megan, I have been talking about compassion fatigue for a few years now, and I've lectured and done panels on these topics at veterinary conferences. And I was like, okay, we're going to talk about this. We talked about it ahead of time. And I was like, whoa, I'm in such a different mental place than I was 2 years ago when I recorded a podcast similar to this with Megan. And it's just, guys, it does get better, man. And things change for the better, because it's so, again, I'm still kind of just reflecting, and it's so weird to see how far I've came in just the last 2 years, which in retrospect, that's not that long, even though it may feel like forever. So to start, Megan, I figured we would talk about just definitions of compassion fatigue and burnout and a little bit more about symptoms and what it can look like.
Yeah, and I think it's really good that we're talking about this too, because I think a lot of times compassion fatigue is thought of in fields where you're working specifically with like humans. You know, a lot of times compassion fatigue is talked about with in fields like with first responders or therapists. So in my field, this is definitely something that is talked about a lot. You know, when we're training new counselors and things like that, we talk a lot about this, because any profession where you're engaging in empathy, you know, this is definitely a risk that you could, you know, experience compassion fatigue. And I think that the focus tends to be on like human serving fields, but you know, fields where you're serving animals and humans, like, that really matters as well. So I'm glad that we get that chance to talk about it here as well, because, you know, I think that a lot of people in the vet world and that are working in shelters and with animals are experiencing this as well. So it's just great that we're talking about it. But yeah, so a little bit about just definitions. So I think it's really important to note that there's a lot of different terms that are used when talking about this topic. It's really tough too when you kind of look when you like look around to get like an understanding of what, you know, what are the definitions of these concepts. It's tough because every place kind of defines it slightly different. And so, you know, as we were kind of preparing for this episode, I know Tabitha and I both kind of like, we looked all over the place kind of just doing some research, and there's just, I mean, there's lots of different ways to kind of conceptualize and define these experiences. And so today we're going to be focusing specifically on compassion fatigue and burnout. Like, those are the terms that we're going to be using, although there are some other terms, you know, that may come up frequently when you think about this topic. But so we'll start off with one of the definitions that we could possibly use for compassion fatigue. This is the way that we're kind of going to be thinking about it during this conversation today. But ultimately, it's defined as stress-related symptoms that can be experienced by caregivers or individuals that are in helping professions. And it's often a reaction to working with, you know, maybe people who are currently in distress or have experienced trauma. And it can develop over an extended period of time. And it often results in a reduced capacity for empathy. So like I said, even some of these conceptualizations and definitions are really focused on human serving fields, but that definitely expands to fields where you're serving animals. And you all, many of you are also working with people as well. So, you know, feeling it from both ends, I guess.
Yeah. And thankfully, I think we're starting to address it a lot more in the animal welfare and vet med fields, because like you said, Megan does not work in the animal field, so we love nerding out about the similarities as far as behavior, but all the things. But it's really interesting, because when we chat about this outside of the podcast, we'll talk about what it looks like in her field and what it looks like in my field. And as you can imagine, there's a lot more similarities than you think. But also, if you're a veterinary technician or if you're working in animal welfare, not only are we dealing with things that similar to human healthcare workers that are out of our control and we're doing the best we can and we're seeing animals suffering, but also we have to deal with the humans that are suffering because their animals are suffering, or the human that's very angry and it's not about us, but they're redirecting their anger towards us, or they may be relinquishing their animal, and just a lot of really, really challenging human interactions that I know I did not have the communication skills taught to me at the time. I have grown a lot and I'm still learning. So some of it's easier. And a lot of the things we're going to talk about as far as how to kind of build some resilience to compassion fatigue, or compassion resilience, essentially, at the end of the episode, are things that I've actually worked on really, really hard over the last few years. And I'm not saying that those conversations and those situations aren't still challenging, but I feel like I have a lot more management tools. For example, already, I automatically say, this is not about me. If someone is yelling at me, I'm not justifying their actions, but if someone calls me and says, I'm at my wit's end. I'm going to euthanize my animal because I see severe behavior cases. I used to get really understandably upset about that, not even towards them, but inside. And now that I've been doing this for a while and have more of an understanding, and I understand that they're just over threshold. I'm the first person in most cases, especially with cats, but dogs too, that has even stopped to listen to them, like their family, their friends, even though they're coming from a good place, they're telling them to just relinquish the cat, euthanize the cat, shock the dog, all these very outdated, not helpful things. And, or they're, for example, they're telling them what to do without having the person ask for that. That person may have just wanted to talk to someone about the behavior concerns that their animal was feeling. And literally, I am the first person that has listened to them. And I can't tell you how many 15-minute phone calls that are just introductory phone calls end with the person crying and saying, I have hope now. So that's just one example of how I've gotten a lot more tools to handle difficult situations. Sorry, I said I get off track. But burnout, lovely Dr. Breedlove.
Well, no, but what you said was really great, because it really does emphasize that, you know, a lot of times, you know, people in this field are working with not only animals in distress, but with people in distress. And so, you know, I think that it's very likely, you know, that they may be susceptible to something like this, just because of, you know, it's got an extra layer of complexity to it, honestly. Like, so I'm just glad that you brought that up, because it's important. But yeah, so compassion fatigue, and burnout, a lot of times they get kind of, they have similar symptoms in some ways. So they tend to get kind of,
lumped together. Yeah. People use the same term to describe and don't necessarily understand that although they do tend to happen together, but they are separate things.
Yeah. And so, a little bit more about compassion fatigue. So I want to talk about the symptoms too, of just kind of what it looks like.
Yeah, for sure.
And then we can talk a little bit about burnout next. But so it's lots of different symptoms that someone could experience when they're going through compassion fatigue. So some of what that could look like are sadness and grief, avoidance or dread of working with like some individuals at work, reduced ability to feel empathy towards people, somatic complaints. So some like physical, physical experiences. Addiction, nightmares, frequent use of sick days, changes in beliefs or expectations, detachment, things along those lines. So lots of different ways that this could be experienced. And I think it's a huge, like, wide range of symptoms, because of the fact that, people experience these symptoms very differently. So it may be really hard to pin down and say that it's this, you know, that's happening. So just a wide range of ways people could feel it. So that's kind of a little bit about like compassion fatigue and what that is and looks like. So burnout, like I said, gets often similar with some of the symptoms, but one of the ways that burnout's a little bit different is, so it's, you know, the physical and emotional exhaustion that workers can experience, when they have low job satisfaction or they feel powerless or overwhelmed in the workplace. You know, some of the potential symptoms of what that could look like could be things like fatigue, anger, frustration, negative reactions towards others, negativity, withdrawal, things like that. So, you know, you can see how there can be some overlap or connection between compassion fatigue and burnout, but that they're also different from each other as well.
Yeah. And when you mentioned the physical symptoms, like Megan said, it can look different for everyone. And this is where it can get complicated, of course, because stress, anyone that listens to my podcast or is aware of me knows that I stress behavior affects, you know, your mental health affects your physical health. It's all the same. So you could be struggling with burnout or compassion fatigue and have physical symptoms like headaches, nausea, digestive issues in general, fatigue, cognitive shifts, like where you can't think, poor concentration. But those are symptoms of a lot of other things too. But I think I love that you touched on that, because I know that I'm so much more aware of things now, but I know that if I was suffering prior to getting into behavior, for example, from GI upset or headaches or fatigue or cognitive shifts, I would immediately be like, I would not think mental health. Like, my brain just wouldn't have went there, you know, 8 to 9 years ago. So when it comes to looking at yourself, because you may be struggling with this right now, you may not be aware that you're struggling with this, but be aware that if you are having symptoms, they may be caused by a stress-related thing as well, or a physical thing. It's important to always see a doctor. I mean, that's part of self-care. It sounds silly, but it's really hard to see doctors sometimes for various reasons, but getting general checkups and blood work and ideally catching things before they're bad, preventative healthcare is something that is awesome. But I just wanted to touch on those physical symptoms a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think it is important to note that a lot of those symptoms do overlap with so many other, you know, mental health issues like, you know, anxiety or depression, or there's just so many, connections between that. And so I think one of the things that stands out for me when I think about compassion fatigue is some of that focus on that like reduced ability to feel empathy. To me, that's like the piece that really stands out, is that like feeling just you're not able to give, you know, that the capacity of empathy that you normally would. So that's just the one piece for me that is.
No, and I think it's so important, because I would hope that everybody has empathy, but especially in caregiver jobs like vet med, animal welfare, trainers, you know, it's such a big part of, like, for example, I have to have empathy for the animal, but I have to have empathy for the person. And we've all been there, or we've all seen it. The coworker that makes everyone else cry at work, or toxic, whatever we want to call it, right? That is, they're most likely struggling, like, significantly. I'm not justifying their actions in any way at all, but they essentially have a loss of empathy, not only for the animals in their care, but their coworkers, their friends. You tend to see a huge change in behavior. Like, I just think of a situation where I worked with a technician that made me cry a lot, and they made a lot of people cry at said place. And it was really hard. I almost left that practice due to that, understandably, because no one was really addressing it from a management standpoint. And I, now that time has passed, I'm actually very close friends with that person. And we all, the whole workplace was fairly toxic, and there were some other issues going on. But a big part that led to their behavior was burnout and compassion fatigue. Again, I am not justifying it by any means, but that's where, you know, if someone is trying to attack you or belittle you, things that happen a lot in our field, you know, having just trying to think in your head, it isn't about you. Again, I'm not justifying it. And then maybe asking something like, hey, oh, I noticed that you, I don't know how, Megan probably has a better way of saying it, but I noticed you've been a little tired lately. Have you been sleeping? Is everything cool? Like, just like a check-in to, even when they're like, if someone attacks me, like in a work setting, that's kind of immediately where I go. Like, I don't go on reactive anymore, which is what I used to do. And now I go, what's going on? What's happening? What's this environment? What's the context? Mm-hmm. Have we been working 16 hours? How long have we, how busy have we been? You know what I mean? And then it's a little easier to handle from the other, like from my perspective in that way, because then I can maybe ask the person like, hey, maybe go take an air break. Like maybe just run up to Starbucks to get some coffee or whatever. And by me kind of like reacting to that person in a non-reactive way and actually in a kind of empathetic way, sometimes even in that moment, we're telling them that we care, but also sometimes that breath of fresh air or that leaving the shelter of the hospital for 5 minutes can make a really big difference. But I'm sure you have lots of other awesome suggestions. Because we have a lot of toxicity in my fields, unfortunately, in animal welfare and vet med, it's a very, very big problem. And although based on my experience and research and what I read and what I hear from others, the identifying factors to why they're pretty consistent. Now, our field is still working on all that stuff. But how would you, just because I'm sure there's tons of people that have dealt with this too, how would you recommend dealing with like a coworker that may be more cynical and belittling of not only the person, the general public that's coming in, but also like very judgmental, but towards their colleagues as well?
Yeah, I think that sometimes you can lose, because this kind of popped in my head when you were talking too. It's like, you know, this reduced like ability to feel empathy for people. I feel like sometimes we may not even be aware of that, you know, that experiencing that. And so I was just thinking about how like sometimes people in the same field, it's different sometimes when you talk to someone outside of your field. Like I was just thinking about how like, so when I used to work in this school as a counselor. And so one thing that was really, I worked with middle schoolers, and sometimes it would be like, my empathy would be reduced over time after a while with like, you know, a student that was really upset about like a breakup, someone that they were dating for like 2 weeks. Right. And my empathy is waning because I have these conversations so frequently, and, you know, it's such a, the emotional experience of that job. And so, but that experience of like, I realize that when I leave that space and I like, you know, if I were to talk to someone about like, about my job and say something about how frustrating it is, you know, that I am going, you know, I have to hear these stories at work or whatever, right? That like, someone on the outside would be like, wow, that's really cold, you know, or like, wow, that's like, sometimes people on the outside who aren't doing that job can sometimes see that like lack of empathy for people. So I don't know if like in the field, like if that's something that you guys experience that you can pick up on, like when other people, you know, that are working in the same place as you are like, wow, that was like a rough response. But sometimes like, I just feel like it's hard to.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, it can be challenging because I think there is a bit of a difference. Like, of course, like therapists and counselors get reviews, but there's unfortunately, which I think reviews are helpful, feedback is helpful, but we all know, especially now in this world that we're currently living in animal welfare, for example, or a vet clinic, the person can be exhibiting so much empathy and do their job amazingly, and someone still writes this horrible, like I see it in animal welfare all the time, where people have no idea of resources and what addressing physical and mental needs of an animal looks like and what a shelter looks like. And they just think you should do everything all the time. And the way I think, even though I've read one book on animals and they're just like attack, attack, attack with no context. So that's another part. Now that we're like kind of talking this out, I think a part that in healthcare, I'm sure it happens in caregiving tech like jobs, but I think that those reviews and that feedback is so in our faces as animal professionals. Like there's no, at least at a hospital, which again, there are bad situations. I think feedback is helpful, but you guys all know what I'm talking about in this, as far as what I'm talking about in this specific conversation. But I now that I'm kind of thinking the differences, it is right in our face. Like people are saying all this horrible stuff about a shelter on social media, and it is completely false and it's so hateful. Like, it is the most hateful shit I have ever seen. Like, it's damn, y'all. Like, I'm sure we've all experienced this, which probably adds to our compassion fatigue and burnout. But just, I thought that that was interesting because I'm like, oh, that's probably different in animal welfare and vet med, because those reviews and that feedback is like fucking in our face. Like, we don't even have like HR. I mean, most animal welfare and vet clinics do not have HR. So there's not even like a person to take some of that off of us. So I think that's an extra challenge. But as far as what you're saying, as far as sometimes it's so easy to be unaware.
Yeah.
Because like that friend of mine, she has apologized so many times. And I was like, because we're all happier now that we're out of that environment. And I'm just so happy that she's thriving and that her mental health is better. And with her, it was probably a little bit of compassion fatigue, but it was more of a burnout, because as soon as she left said place, she was in a very different place mentally. Which burnout is, again, both things are very challenging. Burnout is more, once you leave that environment, you can return to baseline quicker, versus compassion fatigue, which can be a lot more severe. But again, they tend to happen together. But I do think this is why it's helpful to talk to people outside of your field. I'm talking to you, animal people, because I have so many friends that are trainers, veterinary behaviorists, veterinary technicians, people in animal. I mean, I love all of y'all. I have so many close friends and I'm so thankful for it. But I know there's probably times in my life, probably because I was working 20 hours a day and literally had no time for anything, that the only people, with the exception of my partner who does not work in animal welfare, vet med, that I was talking to were people in my field. And that's not the best, because then you're not getting alternative, like, other views. And it's, you never can get away from work truly, because we all know this. So I think sometimes, even though you may not be aware that you have it, your colleagues may not either, because they're struggling with it too. So I have been in situations where I've talked to friends outside of my field and they have my husband recognizes lots of things. Because he knows my baseline. Like, your friends know you and your partner knows you. And if you're acting out of character, if there's a significant or even sometimes a small behavior change, there's a function to that behavior. And as someone that cares about you, they may want to address that. So I think I love that you shared that story, because obviously you're not cold. You're like the most amazing person ever. But
well, yeah, over time, right? Like, some of those experiences, though, you know, I could see moments where my empathy was not where it should be, right? Like, and so that's something that, like, I didn't really realize until I was, like, you know, in, you know, stepping outside of that and just kind of, you know, just hearing that feedback from other people, like, that doesn't sound like you, or, like, you know, that kind of response from others, I think, was something that was like, oh, well, you know, that doesn't sound like me.
That is a really good way to approach it. So instead of saying, you sound like a dick friend, saying, not that any of us would ever do such a thing, but instead of saying that, just saying, hey, that doesn't sound like you. Everything good? Like, that's a beautiful way. Your friends are great. And when that happened, because your job, especially that job, was very, very challenging, mentally and emotionally and all the things. How did you, in that moment, because again, you kind of reflected, were made aware of it, which is the first a very important part. But then how did you deal with that?
Oh my gosh, empathy is so important. And I just think that something that was helpful for me was, like, really going back to that, like, empathy piece of, like, I know, and this is a big thing for me, like, because, you know, we all have judgments, as people, you know, about, like, oh, someone is going through this. You know, and we have, like, for example, with, like, an eighth grader that had a breakup, they're feeling like it's the biggest thing in the world to them. Right. And, you know, I know, like, I've been through a breakup in eighth grade and I'm okay. Even, you know, a lot of times adults tend to look at that younger, you know, that kids and teenagers as being, like, by minimizing their experiences and right. their emotions and things, but really, like, putting myself into their shoes and saying, like, to them, this is really important to them right now. And so, like, put that empathy piece of just, like, you know, really thinking about what they're going through and like, what could they be experiencing, and pulling back my own assumptions and my own experiences and not like projecting that onto them and thinking, because I think that happens so often. I'm talking in the context of like adults working with like adolescents, like a lot of times it's like, you're going to be fine. You'll get over this in 2 weeks. But like to them, it doesn't feel like that.
Right.
You know, to them, their emotions are real and they're with you in that moment and you need to support them through that. And so it's just those moments where it like, it reminded me that like empathy, like, you know, even though there are times, I mean, not just in that job, other jobs too, where I've had, you know, my empathy has definitely been not fully there to where I think it should be. But just really like having that be something that I check in with myself regularly, that I'm making sure that I'm, you know, putting myself into the person's shoes and thinking about what is it that they could be feeling or experiencing and really being open to that and not having my own assumptions and things kind of like getting in the way of that. So, I mean, like with, you know, in the animal world, right? Like, you know, you might be working with people all day long that are, you know, in distress about something with their animal. And, you know, you're in that, you're so much working in that position where you know, you're not the one that's in distress. So it's like, right. You can't really like, maybe you've experienced it before, but it's not forefront in your brain, right? That's like, I don't know. It's just hard to, I'm not making much sense with this right now. I'm sorry.
But, oh, I totally get what you're saying. Yeah.
Like putting yourself in the shoes of like, well, what is it like for that? You know, what could that person be experiencing right now? Or what are, you know, what could they be going through right now? I think it's just a really good thing to just every once in a while check yourself on. Because we don't know what another person is going through always, but you know, we can try to.
Right. Like someone seeing like a treatment plan, for example, which is another thing in the human world. I would love for them to do treatment plans and talk to me about them ahead of time, but that is not something that happens, which is fucked, but that's a whole nother episode. But in vet med, we talk about the treatment plan prior and then we show them the cost. And I'm sure many of you have been in the situation I have where the person sees it and immediately speaks to me very sharply and tenses up and says, this is fucking ridiculous or whatever it may be. And like you said, Megan, I put myself into their shoes and that's not what I've always done, but I have worked towards that. And in many cases, first off, sometimes, of course, they can't afford it and it's causing them to panic because they care about their animal. But in a lot of cases that I have been involved with, they don't understand what's happening and they're overwhelmed. Like we just told them their dog has or cat has a medical disorder or symptoms that they were not aware of. So they're already kind of over threshold. And then we have to go through treatment and management, of course, plans, but they're kind of already over threshold. So taking anything in is really hard. And then they don't actually understand what, yeah, here's a treatment plan. We're going to give an injection. This is for that. These are the pills. She's going to have to come back in 4 weeks. Okay. Whoa. What the fuck does that mean? Like now I understand like how overwhelming that is. I mean, I can't tell you how many clients from a behavior aspect, because I'm a tech, have me go over their treatment plans with them, because they even, and again, most likely they're amazing veterinarians, communicated it well, but maybe at the appointment, they were so over threshold, they could not hear what the veterinarian was saying. And when I was working in GP, if I literally break everything down and go into the whys and I assess their, I understand human body language. I think that's really important, especially for animal carers, because whoa. So if I'm sensing that they, because we could always say like, does this look okay? And they say okay, like, but what is their body language saying, right? Because I say okay at the human doctor, and I'm trying to do better at advocating for myself, and then I leave, and I'm like, fuck, I had so many questions. Why didn't I ask those questions? Now I'm mad at myself. So I mean, that's just one example where they may be sharp and say, what the fuck, I can't. What, you just want to make money? Which I'll be honest with you, it is a bit triggering as an animal professional to hear that, because we make no money and that's a whole separate problem. And it just shows how disconnected the world is, because in that moment, it may be that, but on social media, you see people saying things and it's just mind blowing how disconnected even some animal welfare people are regarding vet care and what's involved in it, and say things like, you're in it for the money, which is, first off, you have a job for money. So tell everyone that. That's what jobs are for. See, now I'm going on a whole fucking thing. Secondly, I don't need to justify my job to you. See, guys, I'm working on it, but I'm aware it's a trigger. But in the moment, I can empathize for that person and understand that this is probably what's happening. So I think that, that's a really good way to handle a lot of the, it's not about you. It can be hard to not take it that way, but it's not about you in that moment.
But like getting in that practice of regularly saying like, what could it be like being in that position right now? I think it's just a good question to kind of be checking in with yourself regularly, because then it'll help you kind of shift that mindset from that perspective that you're, you know, just looking outside of your typical day to day. It's just, it's important to do. And I think that was something that really helped me, just really ground me back to like, oh yeah, like I really need to be thinking more about empathy and really trying to make sure that every day I'm there, like for whoever's sitting in front of me.
Gotta check yourself. I say it all the time when it comes to handling, in all my handling lectures, if any of you have been, you gotta check yourself, deep breathe, oxygen to the brain, check the environment, check the animal. It's like my little, like, I know there's lots of other list people like me out there. It's like my little list that I check off. And now, like Megan mentioned, those things don't just happen. They're work. But over time, you get better and better and better at that skill set. And it's so much better than just being like, well, fuck this person. I fucking hate them. It sounds cliche, but I think we all know that it's not productive to feel that way. So as far as, let's say, you may be feeling some signs of compassion fatigue or burnout as far as where you are working now or where you have worked previously, and you're still kind of working through it and managing it. What are some of your favorite ways to kind of combat compassion fatigue from your perspective, Megan, or burnout, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think, and I think the number one thing that you'll always hear from, I mean, everything that you read about this topic, and also just with me being a therapist and whatnot, I mean, let's talk about self-care, right? Like, that is really, really important. It is. And awareness, I think, like, for me, awareness is really big. Like, being aware of yourself and your needs, and when you're not feeling like yourself, and like having a general understanding of who you are and what you need is really important. And then, you know, following that up with some of those self-care things. So making sure that you're getting what you need. And I think that it all starts with that awareness of like, what is going on with me? What am I feeling? What am I experiencing? Like putting some names to things and understanding a little bit of it. So doing some of that like personal self-reflection, I think everything starts there. So that would always be my first thought, is really like assess yourself in some of those ways. Like, what is going on? What are you needing? Following up in that way.
I think that is a really great place to start, because of course, everybody, I have dealt with compassion fatigue and burnout. Megan has in her job as well. It's a very common thing. You are not alone. You're not being dramatic, and all these silly labels that are out there, your feelings are valid. But also, I have a new mantra: emotions are not facts. They pass. Like, emotions are not facts. I may feel like this right now. I won't feel like this forever, which has been something that I've been saying. I can't remember who I heard say it, but it's like in my brain now all the time, living there, and I love it. But I think a lot of the times, like when I've struggled with compassion fatigue and burnout throughout many times in my career, the worst it was ever was when I was still working in GP and I was suicidal, and there was a lot of other things. It was just, there was a lot. Compassion fatigue was a big contributing factor, but of course these things are complex. Lots of other things were contributing as well. And I'll be honest, I was not aware I was suffering with compassion fatigue. I had a friend who told me. I was like talking about supporting some other vet tech, because we're all caring out there. So I was talking about how, I had a talk with this other vet tech, and she's going to get some resources. And then my friend's like, dude, she's like, you're not like on the verge of compassion fatigue, you're swimming in that shit. You are in the lake or ocean of it. And you have been for a while. And she said it in a very loving way. Because obviously everyone has different communication vibes. And that is what I needed to hear, because I was, and then all these things like hit me in the face. And I was like, oh my God, I am suffering from pretty severe compassion fatigue. And that was one of the reasons, many reasons I left general practice. Obviously I started my own business. I had a lot of other things on my plate. But that identifying it was the first part. And now I'm really great at being aware of my emotional state and being okay with it and understanding that it's not a fact, but that took a lot of time, some therapy, help from other people. So I think if you have a friend that is struggling, I know we talked about a few different ways you can bring that up in a kind way. And I'm sure there's lots of other awesome resources online that you can find before talking to your friend. But again, I was really struggling. Like, it was severe. And I did not know that it blows my mind now. But when you're in it, like, you can't see it.
I think that's why it's so beneficial, like having external supports, like, you know, with other people that know you really well. And like we were talking earlier, like, know your baseline, they know who you are and what to expect. And when they see things that are different or kind of not, that they're standing out, right, they can kind of give you that feedback, because sometimes it's hard to know when we're in the middle of it. So yeah, I think just engaging in self-reflection generally is a good practice. You know, whether that be, I think there's lots of different ways to do that. You know, some people really enjoy kind of like doing journaling experiences. So having like unstructured journaling where they're just like getting things out on a page that are really like coming to mind, or doing structured journaling activities that are things like asking you questions like, what is the meaning of life? And, you know, digging into some of those like personal beliefs that maybe we don't always have a lot of time that we're spending in those areas. Or like, what does happiness mean to you, or what brings you happiness, or things like that. I think some people really enjoy doing activities like that, that really like have a guided, you know, focus for, you know, to engage in some of those like deeper self-reflection pieces. But also, yeah, like the external, like having friends or family that know you well, and giving feedback from them about just about who you are as a person and what, you know, how they experience you in their life. And then if there are things that are off, you know, having that conversation, or having some sort of communication about that.
Yeah, I think that is a great first start. And then I like to focus on the positive, but I want to talk a little bit about what unhealthy coping strategies of compassion fatigue look like, because I'm sure it's relevant in other workload or careers. But again, I'm speaking of my experiences and my friends and colleagues' experiences. And whoa, did I have a lot of these? And whoa, do I have a lot of friends who have a lot of these unhealthy coping strategies for dealing with compassion fatigue? Or again, we may be unaware we have it, but things like working longer hours, we don't delegate. I've talked about this before. I'm not going to ask for help, because when I do, they say no, which is also problematic, because that's some learning history stuff and some learned helps stuff. Either no one's available to help me, or short staff, whatever. No one's available to help me, or they help me and then they do it wrong. So I'm just going to fucking do it. Like, I'm not going to delegate. That is a huge thing. I used to be that way. Not taking breaks. I've talked a lot about that on this podcast. You need to pee and eat. If you have low blood sugar, you cannot function. Not saying no. Again, I have experienced all of these. This is a safe place. Bottling up feelings, being a perfectionist, taking work home, not talking about it, squeezing out hobbies. This is vet med and animal welfare. This is what we do. This is like every person I possibly know. And again, I have done a lot of these things. So those are some, if you notice that you're doing that a lot, maybe that could be kind of, okay, I'm going to take note of that. Again, people will say things to me like, oh, you should work less. That's a very direct comment. And I'm like, it's not that simple. And it isn't. But that person means well. But I do delegate now. I do take breaks. I have practiced saying no, and I I did it yesterday. I'm getting better at setting boundaries. Be sure to check out the podcast episode with the amazing Megan about setting boundaries, because we understand how challenging that could be. So we did a whole dang episode on it. So I think that those are some unhealthy coping strategies. And as far as like healthy coping strategies and things to work towards, and Megan brought this up, this compassion resilience, which I've never heard that term. I love it. It's awesome. Do you want to talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I do want to say something though about what you were just saying.
Oh, please. Yes.
What's really tough about some of those things you were describing too, is that sometimes some of those qualities, like working longer, not taking breaks or not saying no, like can be seen as, sometimes they're like praised in the workplace.
Oh, yes. Facts. Yes.
Like, you know, like they're working, they're staying longer, they're working so hard, right? They're not taking breaks. They're really like into their work, right? I think that sometimes like people can see that as being like it gets praised.
And yeah.
So really, it's like, well, you need to do these things and you need to be cut off at a certain time. And so I just think that that's a really complex part, because especially being, if you're like in a, you know, more management position and you see the, you know, the people that, you know, that you're supervising, right, are doing some of these things, it's really important to know that as humans, they're going to need to have some boundaries and breaks.
Definitely.
Like that, and not to be just always praising people who are grinding so hard that it's hurting, right?
Yeah, management, definitely. That's a really good point, because I think, again, so many of us have been guilt tripped over taking our 5-day vacation that we get 5 days off in a whole fucking year, guys. And we get, oh, must be nice to have a vacation. Like, we get comments like that, which I'm sure I've made those comments before. It hurts my heart that I did that. But that just showed the kind of environments that we're creating. And if you are a supervisor or a manager and you're noting these things, or you are promoting these things, you can't simply say, we're short staffed, this is how it needs to be. No, you're short staffed because you don't take care of your employees and you're causing them all the, like, I think I'm just overhearing that short staffing, to essentially like not take care of your staff, because it's obvious why you're like, is no one looking at data and like why people are leaving? It's so interesting to me, because these things just happen. So, but I do meet with like tons of amazing managers and supervisors when I do consulting with shelters and vet clinics, and I get feedback from the staff and we all talk it through. And in some of those cases, we have recognized that the staff were really struggling with compassion fatigue, and we came up with an action plan and how, like, they were concerned and they understood the importance of taking care of their employees. So again, there's a lot of amazing people out there, but that is a really good note for, like, if people are calling off constantly, I'm not, again, we have to come to work, I get that. But if that's happening with all the employees all the time, then guys, that's probably, yeah, maybe take a note and, you know, break that down. Like, what's going on? Look at the function of behavior. So yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, sorry, that was just a side note.
No, I love it. I love it.
Yeah, sometimes those things just get praised in a way that, you know, it's important to think about.
Or it's essentially kind of, I don't want to say the word encouraged, but demanded.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. This is just part of your job. This is a full-time job, but you work 65 hours a week. You don't have a choice. Like, it's demanded or, yeah, encouraged. Those are really good points. Yeah. But from a positive standpoint, we're going to bring it home. From moving from compassion fatigue to compassion resilience.
Yes. So while I was, you know, kind of doing some on this topic before this, I had come across this one article. So it was published in the Canadian Veterinary Journal in 2021. So it's pretty recent. It's by Debbie Stowen. I'm not sure who that is, but I thought it was really interesting. It's a really easy to read article, and we'll put it in the show notes for you if you want to check it out. But I thought it was interesting because there are some terms that she was using that I hadn't really, you know, I guess heard before, but it made a lot of sense once I kind of like read a little bit about it. But because it talked a lot about compassion fatigue and kind of what it is, but also, you know, focusing on enhancing compassion resilience. And so the word resilience is like, I don't know, it's like so common in my field. I don't know. Do you guys hear it a lot? And do you hear that word a lot?
I hear it from you want to make dogs resilient kind of vibes, but even that, it's not very common in, at least from my experience, I do not hear that.
Yeah. In the education field and, you know, mental health world, the term resilience is like a huge buzzword. But essentially kind of what resilience is it's the capacity to withstand or adapt or recover from difficult or challenging life experiences. So it's that being able to be like bounce back from when you're experiencing difficulties or, you know,
stressful things happen, but I have healthy coping mechanisms and management to return to baseline quicker.
Exactly.
Love it.
Yeah. And so, but what's really awesome about resilience is it's like, it's not something like you have a set level of it your whole life. It's not like a personality feature kind of thing. Like that's, you're just like, you are what you are. It's like something that you can enhance and, you know, grow and just, yeah, make stronger. And so, and I love that about this because, you know, we want to grow those things. So this article, it talked a little bit about, you know, this idea of growing compassion resilience. And so one of the pieces that stuck out to me, because it had, you know, kind of traditional things in there about, you know, enhancing self-care and mindfulness and meditation and things like that, which I think are awesome. Or cultivating compassion for other people and practicing self-compassion as well. So there are lots of like really good points in it. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting was about this idea of growing compassion satisfaction. And so also a term that I was not really like had heard of or anything, but the way that it's defined in this article is the pleasure that's derived from doing one's work as a professional caregiver. So it's like the positive feelings of reward or fulfillment or accomplishment and like being mindful of experiences, you know, or identifying opportunities, you know, where you're making a difference. So I just thought that that was a really interesting concept because, you know, a lot of times we are talking about the compassion fatigue and things like that, but compassion can also have a really huge strength to it as well. You know, if you are in a caregiving field where you're working, you know, with you're leading with empathy and emotions, there can be some really great fulfillment that comes from that as well.
Yeah, so I've never heard this term and I got real excited because I'm going to start using it now all the time. Because again, I love the way you kind of said it where you're like, we always talk about compassion fatigue, which is something we need to talk about, but also we should talk about compassion satisfaction. And I think that this is something I've never defined it by using this term, but compassion satisfaction is one of the reasons I'm still in this field after 12 plus years. And I'm still really happy in this field and I still feel everything extra. I'm just an extra feeler as it is. I feel everything extra anyways. That's my baseline. And guys, you know what? In the last few years, I've accepted that. So I like it. It's fine. And by feel, I mean emotions. Do not take that out of context. But it's, for example, I deal with lots of like many of my listeners out there, I'm sure too. We deal with lots of really challenging things like this senior dog being relinquished after living with, just makes me sad to think about it, after living with his parents for 10 years because they're moving. To be fair, that's what they tell us. We don't know. Or I have a really challenging behavior case and management for multiple, whatever reasons we won't get into, isn't possible with these caregivers. Or seeing a dog that has been mentally broken through inhumane training techniques. It's something that I have to see every week. The positive is I also get to meet, like I recently went to a shelter in Florida this week and I met so many amazing animal welfare professionals that just gave me life. We gave each other life. I went there to do some lecturing on cat enrichment and fearful cat behavior modification techniques and handling. And the whole staff was just wonderful. Or the cat who the client that calls me who has no hope. And then her cat's back in the box within a short period of time. Or the dog that could never be seen by the vet due to fear aggression. And now he loves his muzzle. And see, I'm going to cry thinking about that too. And a good cry. And now can go to the vet safely. And the caregiver also feels safer because their dog was not getting vet care, which was a chronic state of panic if something was to happen to their dog in an emergency situation. Or when you're working with a really fearful cat and they choose to approach and solicit attention with soft body language. That shit is everything. Like, it is, I'm sure many of you are just nodding your heads right now. It's everything. It's why I do this. It's why I probably will never stop doing this. The amount of compassion satisfaction I have is mental. And then, thankfully, I also get reinforced by other people. Clients, animal welfare professionals, people I work with tell me the changes that they have made positively in their own lives or in their animals' lives because of a small impact from me. And that shit, y'all, damn. Like, it, I'm super passionate about my job. Anytime I lecture, all the comments are, she's really fun. She's so passionate. Literally every single comment. And I've been doing this for a really long time. And I'm still just so damn passionate. And I think, although I struggle with some compassion fatigue, I have definitely worked on this compassion resilience. Any of you who have followed me, I have practiced self-care on another level the last few years. I am a trail runner. I am training for a 100-miler right now, which is mental. But it's really cool having goals outside of work. And I can't not, I have to run at minimum 4 times a week and work out, or I will die on the 100-miler. So I need, so I personally need structure to do my hobby outside of work, but everyone's different. I like TV too, but TV is not as much of a hobby. Because usually it's when I'm like super tired. But I have found hobbies outside of work. I practice self-care where, like, today I slept until 10 because I was recently, flew to Florida, did an all day thing, flew home. I was exhausted. So I was like, you know what? I'm not going to get up at 7 this morning to run. I will run later. And that's what self-care looks like. And then mindfulness, I think, Megan, you probably see this a lot too, but when I used to hear that word, I was like, dude, my brain is never going to shut up. Like, my brain is never, ever going to stop. But that is not what mindfulness is.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, mindfulness meditation, like, there's, like, I think a lot of people think of it as being like, it's this you need to meditate or something.
You sit still. And if your brain isn't clear, you suck at it. That's what I used to think.
Yeah, no. I think a lot of times sometimes what people might think of when they hear those words or those terms is like, yeah, this meditation, like silent meditation that you have to just be completely quiet. But that is not always the case, right? I mean, that is definitely one form of what it can look like. But yeah, mindfulness, I think, is just, I think what's really great about it is that you can get in the habit of kind of practicing it, making mindful, like at school, at the school I used to work at, we used to have like mindful moments.
I love it.
Yeah. So it would just be like throughout the day, you know, different points where it would, there would be a focus on like the here and now and kind of what you're experiencing and checking in with yourself. And so it really is just kind of being, trying to check in on the present moment rather than being, you know, in the future, thinking about what's happening in an hour or thinking about what happened 2 hours ago or yesterday or last year. It's really focusing on like what is going on with my body and myself in this moment right now. And so, you know, I love mindfulness. I think it's a great practice to be in. Especially like one of my favorite things about mindfulness is like, and I don't know, I think a lot of people do this and don't realize maybe that they're doing it. But for me, like I like love going to concerts and music festivals. That's like a big hobby of mine. I love it. So one of the things that I love to do is I always try to be super mindful and like really commit those moments to memory and really like, so I have like a couple of concert moments where I like remember being, I can put myself there. Like I could close my eyes right now and tell you like what it smelled like, what it sounded like, the feel of like the speakers, like some of those things, like it's like making that come alive. I don't know. I'm not sure.
That totally makes sense. So for me and Megan, music is a very big part. That's another hobby. Music is a very, very, very big part of both of our lives. And like this summer, I'm going to so many shows and fests. I saw one of my favorite bands. None of you have probably heard of them, but they're a hardcore band named Bane. And they reunited after 7 years in Boston last week. And fuck yes, did I cry during that set while I was moshing and screaming and sweating with hundreds of other kids. I say kids, but adults my age and younger people too. But everyone's a kid at a show in my opinion. But I like it was last week, but I also real talk, 7 years ago, I went to Boston for their last show, and I remember every single thing that happened because they're one of my favorite bands. Emotionally, they get me through a lot. Many of you could probably relate to that. So I think instead of thinking of mindfulness as this thing where you sit and listen to an app, which is also super awesome if you do that, that's awesome. That did not work for me personally. I tried it and then I got more frustrated because I thought that that's what it was. And I was like, I suck at it. And then it added to my anxiety. So you have to kind of think of it as, like Megan said, hey, it might even be, we talked about this earlier, but taking literally 2 seconds at work and taking a deep breath. That is mindfulness. And it's all about shaping, right? We want to break things into small steps, set realistic goals for you. And realistic goals might be, I'm going to be in the moment for 1 minute today. Or when I go to the show, the concert, my phone is off. Or for example, I trail run. That is my meditation. I will run for 5 hours by myself. And it took me a while to realize it. And then I was like, duh, this is my meditation. Of course it is. So it's not necessarily mindfulness, meditation, self-care, because they kind of all go into one. It could look different for everybody, and yours may be different than mine. And I think starting with just a second at a time, because that was really hard for me at first. And now I'm like, I want to run by myself. I don't want to run with other people.
Yeah, I highly recommend that next time you are in a place that you really want to commit to your memory. You know, maybe it's something that a time when you're just like, you're feeling so great and you really want to remember this moment. I mean, just literally stopping in that moment and saying like, okay, what do I feel right now? What do I smell? What do I see? Like going through the senses, right? And that just like really stopping and focusing on all of your senses in that moment and really just trying to commit that to your memory, because that's helpful for me, because like when I do have really rough times and moments, like it's like in a filing cabinet that I can just like pull out of my brain and revisit. And it's just like, it's just a good feeling to put myself there again. So I think it's a good place to start, is like start with at a time or a place that you really want to be revisiting.
I love that. And it's also really important to have social support, family, friends, colleagues that support you, and hopefully you have a place that you can feel safe to discuss your feelings and emotions and to have people discuss them with you. And if you feel like you don't have that, you are not alone. We love you here at Tales from a Vet Tech. And although sometimes it could feel very lonely, especially in animal welfare and vet med, you are not alone. As someone who recently felt really alone for an hour after seeing something in animal welfare and feeling like it's, even though I'm doing all this stuff and so many of my amazing colleagues are doing all this stuff, nothing's changing and we're going back. Cause again, guys, I'm realistic. I do have moments like that. And I do have a support system. And then I realized I know all these other amazing animal welfare professionals and it is going to get better and we're going to keep doing this. And I felt that. I let myself feel that for an hour. And then I realized there's so many amazing people. We're going to keep doing this. And that I wasn't alone, which is not something I used to be able to get myself out of. So these are skills, and you get better with them at time, this whole compassion resilience. And then also just a fun thing that may be helpful. All of you are amazing. I actually created a box on my desk, but I also have a folder on my computer. Every positive review from a lecture or a client or someone who has utilized my resources and they've really helped a lot, or thank you notes, I have them in this box and also in that folder. So on the days I am having, kind of like Megan said, like I go back to that show, you can go back to this place and be like, this will pass. I'm so great at my job. I need to remind myself of why I do this for a living and go back and have that for a resource for you, because you are amazing. But even the most amazing people can have challenging days, and to have those things right at your desk or on a folder on your computer to be able to look at can be really, really, really helpful.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I think it's good to have those reminders or a place where that information, you know, or those keepsakes exist, right? As a reminder of why this matters and why the work that you do is amazing. I just think, yeah, it's tough with this topic because, you know, a lot of times it's like self-care, you know, go do yoga, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh, just do this, whatever. But it's not always that simple, right? And so as much as you can do, you know, to try different things and see what works for you, because it's not, you know, it's not one thing that works for everyone, but just playing around a little bit with some of those things and trying different, you know, what would work for you and being flexible to that is important.
Yeah. Don't set expectations, because again, I think many of us in this field are perfectionists. And even with self-care, we feel like we should be perfect at it. And to start, for me, I started with seeing a therapist and hiring a personal trainer. And really, I started with just drinking water every day and not taking my laptop to bed. Those were my first steps. And then it was not looking at my phone 30 minutes before I go to bed. Tiny little steps. So those steps may look different for you, but you may not be able to go on a 2-hour trail run by yourself right away. It took me years, or whatever your self-care looks like. Just set realistic goals. And even, hey, I'm going to go to sleep and again, not look at my phone for 30 minutes before bed and have a cup of water before bed. That is huge self-care. That's amazing. I'm going to make a doctor's appointment. I'm going to see my dentist once a year. That is amazing self-care. So don't have so much expectations of yourself. And start small and it will grow. But I really appreciate you coming on to talk to me about this very important topic, Megan.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I love coming to visit.
Oh, I know. She just comes. I love my co-host, Megan. And hopefully many of you found this helpful. I'm sure many of you struggle with this as we do in this field. And like I'm going to say it again, you're fucking amazing. You are not alone. Please keep doing what you're doing. And if you can't continue to work in this field, that's okay too. Do what makes you happy. But again, you guys are amazing. And to end, I just like to always ask my guest or my guest host, what is something that currently brings you joy, Megan?
Oh,
heavy.
Question. I think something that's bringing me a lot of joy right now is, so as I mentioned earlier, I like love music, love concerts. You know, I haven't really been to too many since I got pregnant right before the pandemic, and then the pandemic happened. And so I just feel like I haven't been in the concert world in a long time, and I do concert photography. So I love doing that. It's like one of my favorite things in the whole world is taking photos of bands that I love. And so one thing that I'm very excited about is there's a couple of festivals I have on my radar right now that I'm applying for to go get a photo pass and photograph. So just looking forward to just getting back into that a little bit more and having that be part of my life again, because it feels like a lifetime ago. So just looking forward to that, I guess. And it's bringing me a lot of joy thinking about. So
I'm so excited to see your photos. Megan is the one that takes all my bio photos and the photos on my website. She's amazing. And I love music too. So I'm trying to get her to apply to all the festivals I go to so she can take photos of the bands I like. And I obviously want to hang out with her as well. Hopefully you guys are doing some things for yourselves this summer. I really appreciate you guys listening, and I hope you guys all have a wonderful day. Thank you.